Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Margaret Washington. Washington is a professor of history at Cornell University. Her fields of teaching and research include African American history and culture, African American women, and Southern history. She's written dozens of essays and papers on the African American experience and is author of two highly regarded books, the award-winning A Peculiar People, Slave Religion and Community Culture Among the Gullahs, and her recently published expansive and fascinating biography, Sojourner Truth's America, which was published by University of Illinois Press in April of this year. Welcome to the show, Margaret.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I often wonder what it is that moves people to want to study history and spend their time navigating in the past. Tell us what motivated you to want to become a historian.
Well, I liked books, and I always liked history. And I originally actually intended to be a psychologist, but clinical psychology turned out to be something that required more science than I expected. And so one of my advisors in college just suggested, he says, well, look at all your history grades. They're all straight A's. But it never occurred to me to become a historian. And then he said, well, major in it. And so that's sort of how I got into it, and I loved it. And it just became something that was second nature to me.
I'm sure you could use certain forms of psychology to
absolutely
to inform
right.
yourself.
And I wanted to have a field that communicated with people, and so I convinced myself that historians are communicators.
They are indeed, absolutely. They communicate from the past to the future. Yeah. Now your primary focus has been African American experience. Have we even touched the tip of the iceberg in regard to unveiling African-American experience in this country? Is there still so much to reveal?
It's such a vast field. I think we're making a lot of progress, but there is so much more to be done, particularly with African-American women. Mm. When you think about the amount of scholarship that has been done on black women compared to other women, there's actually very little. That was one of the reasons that motivated me to write about Sojourner Truth, because when I came to Cornell and began for the first time to teach women's history, there was no biography of Sojourner Truth.
Really?
No, there wasn't.
Because there's a lot of writing about her now. And
right.
I was just wondering why you were so interested, because the thread of Sojourner Truth runs through your whole resume.
Right. Well, when I came here, I was a Southern historian. I had never written about the North. But I had the advantage of teaching women's history for the first time, which at my previous institution, UCLA, I did not do. So, of course, Sojourner Truth was going to be at the top of the list. And yet I was amazed to find that I couldn't find anything on her except the narrative, which had not been in print for many, many years. So I really wanted to do the narrative, and I wanted to edit it and annotate it, because many people in literature considered it to be abolitionist propaganda. And in order to use it in the classroom, I had to authenticate it. So that's what I did first, and that turned out to be a big job.
Oh, I'll bet.
So after I did that, I said, well, I've done all this work, and I want to go on. And so that's when I got into the biography.
And so did you want to tackle her life in a new context with this? This is an expansive biography, fascinating biography.
I wasn't really sure how I wanted to tackle it at first, but what happened was, in the process of writing about her, or actually researching her, two other biographies came out. And so I had to figure out what could I say about Sojourner Truth that was different from what had been said by these two biographies. And so that, along with some personal issues, I thought gave me a different kind of sensibility about her that I thought I could bring to a biography. And also, I thought that there were some aspects of the previous biographies that I disagreed with.
I noticed that in the book.
I could highlight.
You obviously come to this book from a more feminist perspective.
Yeah. Right. I saw her as a feminist. Now, I don't use that term. I use the term womanist because the 19th century women activists did not call themselves feminists, and so I try and give voice to my subjects themselves. But the whole conception of women's rights and women asserting themselves politically, collectively, was very important as a historian of women, I thought it was really important to really target that. And Sojourner, in some ways, was always an assertive woman. Even when she lived in a patriarchal Dutch household, mm-hmm. she was always very outspoken and very independent-minded. So I wanted to convey that without really putting her in a political perspective, because for much of her life before she became Sojourner Truth, she was not really overtly political.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, she was a very assertive woman and took care of herself. And really, I think, events, the ideas that what we would call feminism, that was part of her persona.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about her, because I think a lot of people don't know a lot about her, you know, pamphlets that they can pick up in history museums. But,
mm-hmm.
but you know, talk about the fact that she spoke Dutch as her first language. To tell us a little bit about her early life.
Well, she was born in 1797, as she would say, when she was born. There were no telegraphs, there were no railroads, just sloops and wagons. And so she was born in a very rural culture that was essentially Dutch. The Dutch were the majority in that part of New York, the Hudson Valley, the mid-Hudson Valley of New York. So her slave owners, she was born in slavery, her slave owners were Dutch, and the men spoke English, but the women spoke nothing but Dutch. And so she grew up in a Dutch household until she was sold at the age of about 12. And at that point, she had several owners after her first experiences. And at that point, she was in a household that was half Dutch. Her owner was Dutch. His wife was half English and half Dutch, mm-hmm. but his wife spoke Dutch, and so she was still in a Dutch ambiance. And according to her, she didn't learn English well until she went to New York City at the age of 30.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And then to become not only fluent in English, but a great orator in English as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But never learning to read and write.
Yeah, that's the part that just amazes
yeah.
me. Who would have thought somebody could have such an effect on history who was, you know, pretty much illiterate?
Right, yeah. And I think that, you know, that also had to do with her Dutch background, because most people who have studied Dutch American women in the 19th century to the mid-19th century, maintained that they couldn't read and write. In the process of doing the biography, in my research, it was very interesting that many Dutch women signed their wills with X's, mm-hmm. as she did when she died.
Mm-hmm.
So part of that, I think, was that Dutch women did not want to learn English. And, of course, the state of New York was English. And so they just basically avoided English. They spoke Dutch at home. They spoke Dutch in their churches. They were insular in the sense that they basically dealt with each other. And so they avoided English in this way and still maneuvered very well, because they were also, like Sojourner Truth, very industrious women. They worked outside the home. They ran taverns. They were prominent in the church, although never holding an office. They were very influential.
Mm-hmm. To talk to us a little bit about Sojourner Truth's religion and her Christian conversion and how that changed her.
She was born into a very spiritual family. She was born into a land-rich Dutch pietist family, and Dutch pietism, with its sense of evangelicalism, was very close to Methodism, except that the Dutch did not believe in religious conversion for their slaves.
Mm.
So she never grew up going to church. But the family was quite religious, and most of her religious background as a young woman came from her early experiences in the Dutch home, where the women prayed and everyone in the household, including the slaves, sat around the table and listened to prayers, sang hymns, and so on. So she grew up in that kind of an atmosphere. But it was really once she took her freedom, as she said,
mm-hmm.
In her late 20s, and she was exposed to Methodism, that she was converted. And this conversion, which was a soul grappling confrontation with God and the intercession of Jesus, basically changed her life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, she never looked back. That, for her, was her real liberation. It was, for her, more liberating than taking her physical freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you talk a lot about it in your books, more than I'd ever read in regard to the details of it. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. And the thing is that I find so fascinating is that even after she was converted under her new association with Methodism, that was not what solidified her sense of calling. Conversion is justification, but she needed sanctification, that is, the concept of being holy, having a sense of holiness, and having a sense of being chosen. And that came later. But once she decided that she had been chosen, she never wavered from that, mm-hmm. and that really changed her life.
Yeah, and you know, I didn't realize that she gave birth to 5 children.
Right,
that
yeah.
came out in your book too. Then I was surprised by that.
Yes, she did. She had 5 children, one of whom died young. We don't know how young, but while she was still in slavery in her last with her last owner, who owned her for 18 years, that was a boy. That was her firstborn. And then she had 3 daughters and another son. Her son, who survived until early adulthood, was sort of the catalyst in her early life because he was sold away. And part of her sense of mission was getting him back. He was sold south. And getting him back was an amazing feat. No one thought that she could do it, mm-hmm. but she did it. And so that solidified her belief that God was on her side.
Yeah.
And he died, we think, at sea at the age of about 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then her 3 daughters lived to old age.
Yeah, I found that really remarkable. Now tell us when she became Sojourner Truth, because her name was Isabella before that.
Right.
To tell us how that happened.
She dubbed herself Sojourner Truth at the age of 46 in 1843, after having been in New York City for 15 years, where she preached, worked in reform movements. She was one of very few black women at that time who actually did reform work with white women. But that was not getting her the spiritual satisfaction that she wanted. So in 1843, she decided to leave the city. She had had some very traumatic experiences in New York City, and Sojourner was, and as far as her sense of assertiveness was concerned, she did not mind confronting the legal system. As far as she was concerned, the legal system was there for her. She used that when she was trying to get her son back in New York City. She actually was implicated in a murder trial. And that tarnished her reputation because she was a fairly well-known street preacher in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
But being implicated in this murder trial and being involved in this cult tarnished her reputation while she was in New York City. So she wanted a new beginning. And she decided in 1843 that the voice of God was calling her outside of the city. And so with no sense of what lay beyond, she decided that she was going east and she was going to change her name. And her name change reflected her spiritual calling because God had dubbed her to be a sojourner for truth, and truth was another name for God. So she was God's messenger.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Margaret Washington. She's a historian at Cornell University, and we're talking about her fascinating new book called Sojourner Truth's America. Now, you've done a lot of research on Sojourner Truth. When you put this book together, did you find anything new that you hadn't come upon before?
Well, there were a lot of things in it that I think are new. For one thing, I was really amazed at how close she was to black people. I think historians, the few who write about her, have tended to see her as sort of a woman apart, that she really was not someone who was close to her own people. And I found that to be untrue. I found out that Sojourner Truth not only embraced her people in terms of her deeds, but that it was reciprocal, that she had a very close relationship with African Americans. She spoke in black churches. She spoke at the Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York City. So that was important to me, to link Sojourner Truth to her own people. The other thing that I brought out in the book that no one else has brought out is Sojourner Truth was deeply regarded by white women. And that was important. It was important for me to look at that and investigate that, because the previous biographers suggest that she was kind of used by them and that they wanted to have her around because she made them feel good about themselves.
So like a token.
Right, yeah. And so I wanted to look at that. And I found some wonderful letters written by her white associates to her that revealed the closeness. And I found also recollections and diaries, the kinds of documents that people don't expect anybody else to see, and where they talk about what a majestic woman she was. Some of the material that I found that was just very moving were journals that women, white women, young white women, wrote to their babies.
Wow.
They would, and this was during the Civil War and afterwards, there was this tradition among women to write journals for their children so that they would read them when they grew up. And the friends of Sojourner Truth's daughters would write their journals to their children, and then they would talk about Sojourner. They would describe her. They would say things like, "She is the finest woman I've ever met," and then talk about why they felt that way. So these were journals that weren't meant for anyone else except the eyes of these children when they became adults. So there was a closeness there that I think historians have overlooked. So it gave her a different perspective, in my opinion, and a perspective that I think it's important for people who study women and study race relations in the 19th century to understand, that Sojourner Truth was not someone created by white people. Mm. That there was a, well, I have to say that some people did create a Sojourner Truth myth, and I think that therein lies the problem, which is why historians have suggested that she was basically sort of a token. But, you know, you've got the myth makers and then you've got the reality. And when you look at people like Harriet Beecher Stowe, yes, for her own purposes, she did mythologize Sojourner Truth. But Sojourner Truth was already well known among progressives before she even met Harriet Beecher Stowe. So you do have these two images of Sojourner. But I don't think that the image that we have painted by Stowe is the real Sojourner.
Mm-hmm. God, it's amazing how much can still come out about this woman.
Yeah, and there's more to be discovered, because I couldn't do everything. And I think that some historian is going to come along at some point and really get into Sojourner Truth's years in Washington, because during the Civil War she worked among the freed people in Washington for maybe 2.5 years, and that represented another part of her life. And she always kept contact with that, because she started a movement to get Washington, D.C. freed people out of Washington into the West. So there's a story there that I could really only touch upon in part of a chapter that I'm sure has a tremendous influence on history of women, African Americans, and I think on Civil War and Reconstruction.
Yeah, it fascinated me the way you described her, too. I didn't realize she was 6 feet tall and this charismatic, really attractive
woman. Right, yeah. And those descriptions come from people who knew her and were amazed not only at her oratory, but at her persona, because she was really a personality. And that was one of the things that I tried to convey in the biography, that her commanding presence, her height, and she's 6 feet tall at a time when a tall man is 5'9 or 5'10.
I was thinking that.
Right, yeah. Slender, with dark skin, and always wore traveling clothes.
I love that.
Right, a thick dress with the velvet apron and traveling shoes, and it was only after the Civil War, actually during the Civil War, when her friends decided that she was ill and she couldn't travel, she couldn't sell her narrative, and she had become popular by virtue of the Civil War. So her friends wanted to find a way for her to earn a living. And so they and she decided that she would sell her image, which was called her shadow.
Ooh.
And so they dressed her like a Quaker. And she was always a very fastidious dresser anyway. So it was no huge leap to suggest that she wear black dresses with a Quaker bonnet and a large Quaker apron that Lucretia Mott gave her. And basically she got rid of her traveling clothes unless she was traveling, which she still did. Once she thought she was going to die, but she didn't die. She lived another 25 years.
She lived
years.
A long life
right,
for that
did.
Time, didn't she?
Right, yeah.
And a fairly healthy life up until
yes, she
the
did.
Last
she was
years.
She after that illness, she was she had her sick moments, mm-hmm. but her friends would care for her, and she'd get over that illness, and then she'd be back on the road again.
Yeah, she's amazing. It's an amazing book. I really recommend people reading it because it fills out some of the questions you have and makes her more of a real person. For me, it did. Yeah, fascinating book. Now you published a book called about the Gullah people. Am I saying that right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
The Gullah people?
The Gullahs.
Tell us a little bit about them. It's a fascinating group of people that still live in the olden days in some way.
The Gullah book is about the African-Americans who live in South Carolina. Actually, the Gullahs of South Carolina and the African-Americans of Georgia, this is on the coast of both states, are pretty much one and the same. The difference is the Gullahs are called Gullahs and the Georgians are called Geechies. But the cultures are the same. And I focused on the Gullahs. I actually didn't realize that these two states essentially were responsible for importing Africans from Africa who had similar cultures. So I focused on South Carolina enslaved people. And the Gullahs were a fascinating people because they were able to retain segments of their African culture because of their isolation in the coastal regions of South Carolina and on the fringe of islands along the coast of South Carolina. And because they outnumbered the white population 8 and sometimes 10 to 1, mm. and because it was an absentee plantation system. So they lived in a self-contained environment, developed their own language, which was a combination of various African tongues and English. They maintained various customs, various healing practices that came from Africa as well as from the natural environment that they found in South Carolina, and the coast of South Carolina and these islands was semi-tropical. So the roots and herbs that they found and experimented with comprised their healing practices. They were people who practiced a very interesting kind of religion, which is what I focus a lot on in mm-hmm. the book, which was a combination of African beliefs and segments of Christianity, which, like many other aspects of African-American history and slavery, was not the kind of Christianity that we think of, because there was no concerted Christian movement in South Carolina among the slaves until the 1830s. So they had a long gestation period of creating a Christianity and an Africanity and merging it into what I call Gullah folk religion.
Mm-hmm. And then they still maintain this culture to this day, do they not?
They do. It's been diluted greatly. But even that fragmentation didn't begin until the Roosevelt era of the New Deal, when they built bridges. But it has, at this point, been fairly diluted because of the contact with the mainland, because of the fact that a lot of the land that they own, because, of course, this is a very beautiful part of America, has been bought up. Mm. And the island that I focused on greatly in my book, St. Helena, was completely black-owned after the Civil War. And many of the people now have lost that land. because of various reasons. The families sold it. Sometimes it was divided so much that there really wasn't very much left. And also because the tax base changed. When people come in, when they're able to get a foothold and an outsider, buy land, build a big house, and you get enough of those, and then their little truck farms are still there, but the tax base is going to be such that they can't afford to stay.
Gentrification.
Right,
in
exactly.
Those places.
Right, yeah.
God, that's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Now, are you still working on research? This was in your biography about race relations in Central California.
I am working on that. Right now, what I'm thinking about doing with that is I'm very interested in post-1945 and especially in the 60s, 1960s. And so what I've been doing with that project is doing a lot of oral interviews with people who were activists in the Vietnam War and activists in Northern California, the San Francisco Bay Area, and in Sacramento, which is where I'm from. And so I am thinking about, rather than doing race relations per se, which is what I was going to do, and I was going to look at a transition that explains why small cities such as Sacramento develop differently from large cities in terms of race relations such as Los Angeles. That is to say that there is not neighborhood proscription and segregation. So blacks and whites, Asians, Mexican Americans all grow up together and interact together, but where the proscription and the segregation comes in is economic in these smaller cities. And so that's one of the things that the 60s opened up for them. But neighborhood-wise, people lived together, and that explained a lot of the activism in these cities because these students had grown up together, whereas in some of the larger cities, such as Los Angeles, they were segregated from each other. Mm-hmm. So there was really not much of an understanding of each other. So they were able to create a movement that brought economic change so that you had African Americans and Mexican Americans working at banks, working in the utility companies in the 60s, the late 60s, and you didn't have any of that in the smaller cities of California before. Mm-hmm. So that was what I was going to do, but in the process of working on that and doing research on that, I found all this information about the anti-war movement that no one has done anything with. Not only with the anti-war movement in Northern California, but I did a lot of oral interviews with Vietnam veterans themselves who had been part of the anti-war movement and then were drafted and then went to Vietnam and did anti-war work while they were in Vietnam. So I've gathered these oral histories, and I'm still trying to figure out how I'm going to maneuver that. It's a tremendous amount of material.
Interesting stuff, though.
But it's fascinating.
I hope you continue with it.
Yeah, it really is fascinating.
Well, Margaret Washington, we have run out of time, and I want to thank you so much for joining us. And please go out and get her book, Sojourner Truths America. You'll learn so much if you go out and read it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.